This is an ABC podcast.
Our GP hasn't basically given us any more information than that they're seriously concerned, and effects could be years, months, even decades down the track.
A lead contamination scare in the New South Wales Southern Tablelands region has left a young child exposed to the heavy metal and his family asking for answers. And life on a cattle station is a dream for many children. We meet the WA pastoralist who are giving foster children that very experience.
You can't imagine the reward of seeing something that seemed, that was so broken, become a confident, beautiful young human being. It's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. Really, really rewarding.
First tonight to the ongoing coronavirus situation. As more cases are confirmed, some businesses and organisations have already taken forward planning steps to prepare their staff to work from home. Late last week, Telstra told office staff to work from home if they can until at least the end of the month. Even here at the ABC, there are measures being put in place so that staff are able to work from home should that become necessary. But just how prepared is the Australian workforce should the need arise for more of us to work from home? Libby Sander is an assistant professor of organisational behaviour at the Bond Business School. She spoke to Kate O'Toole about some of the challenges that could face workers and employers if more people work from home.
Look, a lot of workplaces now have flexible work arrangements, which can include working from home, but it doesn't often include staff working from home permanently. So I think it's going to be a big challenge because most people who do work from home still come to the office maybe 3 or 4 days a week. So thinking about how would you coordinate things remotely? Do we have the technology in place to actually be able to support those activities? And also people feeling isolated, both socially and professionally at home, perhaps dealing with children who are schooling at home if that happens. So there are a lot of unusual factors to consider here that most businesses probably aren't well prepared for.
That's Libby Sander, an assistant professor of organisational behaviour at the Bond Business School, reflecting on the preparedness of the Australian workforce to work from home. Globally, hundreds of firms are sending people home to work. I've mentioned Telstra. Also, Ernst & Young are asking thousands of employees to work from home. Tech company Atlassian in 48 hours made their entire company remote. Jo Palmer is ahead of the curve on this. She runs a recruitment hub for professional candidates living remotely in regional Australia. She did this from her home at The Rock, half an hour away from Wagga Wagga. It was born out of a backyard barbecue discussion with a group of like-minded skilled professionals who wanted to stay living and working in regional Australia. And it was for her efforts in this area of connecting regional Australians to work that helped her win the 2019 National Rural Woman of the Year Award. Jo Palmer, welcome to Australia Wide.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, how big is the shift we are seeing with coronavirus and the way we may work over the coming weeks and months?
I think that this shift on people being forced to work remotely because of a health crisis has meant that people are really going to see that this isn't all bad. This working this way is not as diabolical as they may think, that actually they're going to find that the people that are working for them are just as productive, if not more productive. So I think that even though this is pushing this whole concept in a really rushed way, the silver lining of it is that people are seeing that this is going to be a really way that people work in the future.
And specifically for regional Australia, do you think it will really have some revealing impacts on the way we work in regional Australia?
Yeah, 100%. Look, our platform is open to people living anywhere in Australia, so whether you're metro-based or through to regional, rural and remote. But what we've always advocated for is that remote work is a real leveller of the playing field for people living regionally, so that if an organisation is willing to hire someone remotely, then it genuinely doesn't matter where they live. And the economic and social benefits of putting salaries into rural areas, especially in these dry times or after fires and floods, that the impact that that has is huge for the regions.
What are the main issues people need to consider when attempting to work from home, the pros and cons, if you will?
some of the challenges are around focusing on your work, like those distractions when you're working from home can be a real thing if you don't have that ability to focus and use your own autonomy and time management skills to actually get your work done. But it doesn't take long for people to sort of get into the swing of things like that. And often what we see is the issue of not people not being productive. It's the complete opposite, is that they're burning out because they're not switching off and they're not having enough breaks and they're not keeping that work-life balance happening that often happens when you've got a commute on either side of your workday happening.
You've mentioned productivity. What research is there on people's productivity for those who work from home, and can productivity be maintained?
I'm a very big advocate for the ability to maintain productivity. I run a completely remote web-based company. So my team are in across three states in Australia, and we don't have a head office, and everyone works remotely. And how I've set the business up has meant that I don't have to be watching over people's shoulders and tracking time to make sure that they're at work. That we've set it up so that if you set tasks that need to be done either daily, weekly, monthly, and everyone knows the expectations, then people do the work when best suits. The way working like this is really enabling for people to be productive, but it's definitely not for everyone.
Does that go some way to perhaps our perceptions of regional Australia as well, that perhaps that blue collar image, living on working on the land and what have you, is perhaps being changed somewhat, that there is a white collar, increasingly white collar workforce and office styled workforce in regional Australia?
100%. This is what I'm advocating for on a daily basis, is that we've got an incredible talented professional candidate pool of people that live and want to stay in the regions, and that access to remote work will let them stay in their areas and spend locally and keep their kids in schools. But I think what's going to be amazing about this is that because organisations have been forced to let people work remotely, the argument to say it doesn't work won't be there anymore. And I feel that this could be a huge potential of decentralisation to the regions of people that want to leave the rat race that is the city, who can't afford the mortgage or don't want to sit on a train for 2 hours each way going into an office that to do a job that they really could be doing from home.
So you feel then that the coronavirus and the way we work, there will be profound change that will come from this situation?
I think that there will have to be, that people will see that this works, that the mindset around trusting your employees to actually do the work that you pay them to do is just, you give them that access to do it and set them up for it to be something that they can do effectively. And the benefits are going to be not only for the workers, but for the organisations as well.
So there aren't many silver linings to this situation, but it appears as though you might have struck upon one. Jo Palmer, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Not a problem.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
While there may be many thousands of workers who do end up working from home, for many in the service and hospitality industries, that's simply not possible. As states, schools and communities put measures in place to help prevent the spread of coronavirus, cafes across Newcastle are introducing their own safety measures from today, including banning keep cups, promoting cashless payments and placing restrictions on dining in. Larice Dixon stopped by a local cafe to chat to barista Sam about why her cafe decided to bring in these measures.
Sam, we're standing in the cafe right now. There's a sign out the front on the bench. Why have you guys decided to put that there this morning?
So we're just trying to keep up to date with all the other cafes in town. A lot of cafes are stopping all eat-in orders, so just doing takeaways and trying to stop the spread by employees not touching customers' cups and property.
I've just given you a keep cup to make my coffee in, but I understand from the sign that you're not going to be accepting them anymore. Why is that?
Just to, try and stop the spread. So we're trying to take stepping stones into stop accepting keep cups. So by that, we're just putting the sign out today to let customers know. And then if it gets worse, then we'll probably have to stop all eating orders. And eating orders will just be in takeaway cups and takeaway boxes. So
is it to do with people not washing their keep cups properly, or is it just the constant contact?
Yeah, so more the contact, like we know all our customers have clean cups and whatnot. It's more for them bringing a cup into the cafe and having contact with it from them. It's just trying to keep us employees safe from the spread.
And how have people reacted to the sign being up this morning?
Everyone's been really good, actually. Like, I think most people have kind of heard from other cafes and stuff, and where I'm trying not to do any posts about it to make it more extreme than it is, but I know a few cafes in town have been putting social media posts up and whatnot about it, but all of them being really accepting so far and understanding, which has been good. At the moment, it seems normal for now. We've actually had a few customers asking, is our business going downhill? And for now, a lot of customers are still saying, we hope you stay open so we can still get our coffees. So it seems our regulars are all right. It's just those flow-ins that we're not sure we will get or not anymore.
Larice Dixon with that story from Newcastle.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
I eat corn sometimes and my mum cooks it in the oven.
Well, Charles, how much rain did we have? He said, no, none. I said, you're mad, man.
ABC Australia Wide.
Because I came from Wynyard area where it rains and rains and rains. And when it's not raining, it's raining more.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman, in for Sinead Mangan. A lead contamination scare in the New South Wales Southern Tablelands region has left a young child exposed to the heavy metal and his family demanding to know how it happened. Their home in Turrigo, northeast of Canberra, had lead levels 15 times what's considered safe because of construction work on the nearby railway. The residents of the small town are angry they weren't informed about the problem sooner. Angelique Liu reports.
There we go, bud.
When Christopher Curtis and his fiancée bought their first home last year, it was meant to be the start of an exciting new chapter. The Curtis family lived next door to a rail corridor where Transport for New South Wales carried out expansion works between July 2019 and January this year. Christopher and his family had only been living at the property for a few months when they were told their home was up to 15 times safe lead exposure limits. Their 17-month-old son was found to have elevated levels of the heavy metal in his system, and the long-term health impacts are largely unknown.
Our GP hasn't basically given us any more information than that they're seriously concerned, and effects could be years, months, even decades down the track. It could take that long for us to have a full grasp of what this actually means for us.
Test results show Christopher and his six-year-old daughter also have elevated levels of lead in their system. The young family is now in temporary accommodation more than 40 kilometres away in Goulburn. Christopher says his family is now living in limbo.
It made us question everything. This is supposed to be a really momentous occasion in our lives, buying our first house, and it's sort of been severely impacted how we feel about everything living there.
In late February, the New South Wales Environment Protection Agency issued a draft declaration stating the rail corridor next to the Curtis family home was significantly contaminated. The agency told the ABC it believed the contamination of the site was caused by the transportation of lead ore from the former Woodlawn mine. But questions have been raised about when Transport for New South Wales knew about the risks. The Curtis family, the Goulburn Mulwarrie Council and the community were only told about the contamination last month. New details have since emerged at a community meeting in Tarago last week.
So 2015 you knew it was contaminated site.
That's what you're saying earlier.
That's at 2019. You're saying in 2015.
2015, the initial investigations began on site.
And you
the works.
At that point,
it's been revealed the department knew about the existence of lead at the site from as early as 2015, but did not publicly announce the risk until February this year. The Mayor, Bob Kirk, says the department has a lot of questions to answer.
Clearly, that's unacceptable that such an issue deserves to be brought to attention to the people, particularly the affected people.
Tarrigo resident Owen Manley says Transport for New South Wales should have come forward sooner.
I was very surprised and quite annoyed in that it really is a case of it appears to have been hidden.
Transport for New South Wales says results show the risk of contamination at the Tarago Public School, the train station and the main street are low and acceptable. But residents say they're unhappy with the way the department carried out testing in the community. Leanne Wells says communication has been poor.
No one's answered my question yet as to why the school wasn't advised at first, why it wasn't either closed until testing was done.
Wayne Bainham is a Tarago local and says the entire community will feel uncomfortable until the new results are revealed.
If Transport New South Wales goes ahead and tests the groundwater and everybody else's that requests testing gets done, people will be a lot happier. Until then, it's just a lot of anxiety because people just don't know what to expect.
Transport for New South Wales spokeswoman Carol Ann Nelson says they could have handled the matter better.
Whilst we might have ticked our regulatory boxes, we're dealing with a community, and as I said, when you're dealing with a community and people's safety and their health, we need to be a lot better at the way we engage with the community.
She says they're offering free soil and blood testing for residents.
So we have a short-term management plan in place at the moment. So that's where we have engaged some environmental experts to tell us how to manage the site to make sure that it's safe. And one of the things that we need to do is then work out what the long-term remediation of these sites are. We'll be doing that with the EPA and with the community.
Meanwhile, Christopher and his partner say their entire future is uncertain.
We were supposed to be going on holidays so my partner and I could get married at the end of the month. And at this stage, we don't even know if where we'll be when we come back or even if we should go. There's no guarantee that our house will be safe. There's no guarantee that we'll have any set accommodation at that stage.
He says he has one wish for the future.
I just want to be able to move past this with my family, happy and healthy.
Angelique Liu with that story from Tarago, northeast of Canberra.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What if it never comes?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman. Now, whether you have kids or not, have you ever considered becoming a foster parent? With all the space and freedom you have, if you live on a pastoral station, it might seem like the perfect location to open up your family to a child in need. That was the feeling for Sean Darcy and Kath Walsh from Linden Station, about 300 kilometres northeast of Carnarvon in Western Australia. Alongside their three biological kids, for the past 12 years, Sean and Kath have taken in two foster children. And during the school holidays, they also take kids on respite. Michelle Stanley hit the road to hear Kath's story.
I guess I had always felt like I wanted to contribute to society in my life, and I probably felt like growing good food for people is a noble cause, but I just wanted to do something a bit more specific and for my local community. When you've got kids anyway, throwing another one in the mix is quite easy. Well, I thought that at the time, and it is, you just cope with it when it happens, but I thought, you know, where there's so many people less fortunate than ourselves and so many children less fortunate than our own children, and I know I'm not the perfect mum and Sean's not the perfect dad, but we're good people and we can love our children and provide for them and, yeah, and provide a beautiful place for them to live and grow up.
We're sitting here and you can hear the wind chimes and the birds and the chickens and the rooster and you've got swings and a silk and a boxing bag and all that sort of stuff around, but it's such a vast station with cattle and horses. What kind of life are you bringing these children to, and what do they get out of living on the station?
Do you know, I think they love-hate coming out, the respite kids, because the devices go on a shelf and they're not allowed to touch them while they're here. They're very addictive and everyone just wants to sit on them all the time. But when kids start getting bored is when they start doing really interesting things, and they invent these great games, and they are got a visitor. So they have this amazing life where they learn to be quite independent in their own entertainment, and they do the most creative, amazing things. You wouldn't believe what they come up with. They love playing in the chook yard with the chickens. We've almost always got baby chicks, which that takes up a lot of time with all kids. And it's a great learning tool of learning to be gentle and just learning all those basic things about where your food comes from and how an egg comes out. Every kid loves watching an egg come out. It's very, very exciting. And how it's soft when it first comes out, and, you know, all of those and all the little strange personalities of the chickens and the dogs and the horses. They really love the horses. And I think horses are really therapeutic for kids as well. It's really good for them. Yeah, I think our kids don't realise how lucky they are. They really don't, to have this freedom that they have here. But you can see the kids that come out from town really appreciate it.
So you've got two children in your care at the moment. It must make it difficult for you as parents and also your biological kids to have people come in from difficult backgrounds with triggers and traumas and behavioural issues sometimes. How does your family as a whole cope with that? How do you get through that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. And it is really challenging sometimes. Those first 2 years with our eldest daughter were definitely, they were probably the hardest 2 years of our lives, Sean and I. It was so challenging. But we just persisted and got through it together. You know, we've got a great relationship. And Sean's an amazing husband and an amazing father. And we pushed through it. And we also had some amazing support around us. We just happened to have some, we had a wonderful, you know, I was teaching the girls. And we had this incredible teacher, Anne, that came through who specialised in traumatised children. And there's also a lot of support from the DC, from the DCP, which are now called the Department of Communities. As for our family, how it affected us, it was hard, but we all grew from it a lot. And we ended up, I think we're much better people on the other side of it. So we've learnt a lot. And for our kids, it was actually really, sometimes it was tough, you know, and it was a bit of a sacrifice. You know, often I'd have to just be with our daughter while the other kids went off and went to the beach or whatever, but that only lasted for a couple of years, that really tough behaviour. And once we're through the other side, she's amazing now. And it was good for our kids because it actually taught them a lot of empathy. And they really got, even though they were very little, they were younger than our daughter, they really got to understand, and they have a good understanding now of how lucky they are and how fortunate they are, and that there's other people in the world that don't have the amazing family and upbringing that they've been privileged enough to have. Yeah, so it's been good for all of us, I think. There have been definitely hard times, but I can honestly say that the positives that I've had out of it have outweighed the negatives. You can't imagine the reward of seeing something that seemed, that was so broken, become a confident, beautiful young human being. It's wonderful, wonderful feeling. Really, really rewarding.
That's Kath Walsh from Linden Station speaking with Michelle Stanley. Kath and her husband Sean Darcy foster two children and have three biological kids as well. And finally, tonight it was another dramatic day for the share market, which slumped at the start of the new week amid coronavirus fears. The ASX 200 closed down 9.7% at 5,120 points, falling more than 2% in the final minutes of trade. It was the worst one-day sell-off since 1987. The All Ordinaries ended 9.5% down, losing $165 billion in value. Oil stocks continue to fall amid the ongoing price war. Woodside Petroleum sank 7.82% to $19.33, while Santos dived 12.23% to $4.02. And the Aussie dollar was at one stage buying 61.6 US cents, down from 62.98 US cents as the market closed on Friday. So it's a rough time on financial markets at the moment, that's for sure. That's Australia Wide for this Monday night. Thanks so much for your company. My name's Alex Hyman. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.